Who's behind this? Who did this to me? Why?
What do you mean, why?
Who is responsible for this?
We put that gun down. You're about to make the biggest mistake of your life.
Welcome to Popped, where you can learn about and relive some of the best that entertainment has to offer. We'll revisit some of our favorite films that helped influence and shape our lives. Now sit back, strap in, and keep your arms and legs inside the vehicle at all times. And if you have to, take a shot of whiskey to keep from swooning when you hear their voices. Here are your hosts,
Daniel, Ben, and Tanya.
Are you going to spend the rest of the evening prying at that clown's mouth?
I
don't... It's frustrating for me if you don't pay attention.
What is this?
This is your game, Nicholas, and welcome to it.
In 1997, PolyGram Pictures released a mystery thriller film called The Game. Directed by David Fincher, The Game is a story about a rich investment banker named Nicholas Van Orton, a man in obsessive control of his life.
His unyielding need for control was spurred by the tragic loss of his father, who leapt to his death on his 48th birthday. Nicholas is truly a man lost in his own trauma, having never meaningfully dealt with the devastation that event wrought.
His dispassionate, humorless, and unpleasant demeanor serves to alienate him from any real human connection. And although he is not seeking redemption, it is offered to him in a peculiar way by his brother Conrad.
On Nicholas' 48th birthday, Conrad gives him an invitation to a company called Consumer Recreational Services, or CRS. There, he can sign up for a once-in-a-lifetime experience called The Game.
In a perfect embodiment of, well, that escalated quickly, what started out as menial puzzles ratchets up to become a fight for his life and livelihood. The controller becomes the controlled. Is this a game, or is it a scam?
Paranoia sets in, and Nicholas starts to fear that he can trust no one. In desperation, he turns to the only people he knows for sure that he can rely on: Conrad, his ex-wife, and a waitress named Christine, who he has a chance encounter with when it all starts to go haywire.
But CRS is always one step ahead, and Nicholas may just lose everything unless he can figure out how to win, no, how to survive the game.
Thus, the plot gives the film its eponymous name. It is an intricate retelling of a rich man's redemption arc bearing a remarkable similarity to Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
The redemption arc is reimagined, however, and the viewer tags along for a suspenseful white-knuckle joyride where the film's protagonist lands into a myriad of uncomfortable situations designed to break him down.
The ultimate goal, of course, is to help Nicholas, the soulless capitalist investment banker, attain the non-material things his life has been lacking: love, affection, community, and humanity.
Nicholas Van Orton is masterfully played by Michael Douglas, who had the unenviable task of making a selfish corporatist a sympathetic character, which he did flawlessly.
Sean Penn's animated yet powerful performance as Conrad served as the perfect counterpoint to Douglas's quiet intensity.
The Game was well received by audiences and critics alike and grossed $109.4 million at the box office worldwide. All right, guys, are we ready to talk about The Game?
Ooh, I love games.
Welcome back to Popped. We're here to talk about the 1997 film, The Game, starring Michael Douglas. There will be spoilers, but if you haven't seen it by now, I don't know what you're doing watching this for. But thanks to everybody who joined us on our last premiere of the film Aliens, which we just covered. I don't know how it went yet because we're still a day before that, but if you were there, you're awesome. We'd like to introduce a special guest who is going to be joining us for this discussion. Someone that I've known for quite some time. His name is Tony Yukina. And welcome, Tony.
Hey, how's it going, Daniel? Long time no see.
Has it been that long?
Unless you're talking about post on Facebook.
Okay. Yeah, it has been that long then. So, Tony, a lot of us here are just meeting you for the first time, and definitely listeners probably will be as well, unless they read your comments on the Blade Runner forum. But please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, nice to meet you all. I am Tony Yukina. I'm pretty much a Bay Area. I've lived in the San Francisco Bay Area since a while, forever. I grew up in San Francisco, and I moved across the Bay to Oakland when I realized there actually is good weather. Living in San Francisco for the first 20 years of my life, I just assumed every day was an overcast gray day, and I seriously didn't realize that there was that many days of blue skies until I moved to Oakland. And so I'm considered, they call me a Bay Area convert. So I love cinema. I think my favorite types of movies are noir related movies. Third Man is probably one of my top four movies for sure. And I had a lot of time to look at movies with that angle in mind as my favorite. And then, of course, we all have certain movies that we just like for whatever reason that you're not supposed to like. Like, I think one movie I really love a lot is Jingle All the Way, which is a horror movie. But yeah. I actually have watched it probably 15, 20 times, and I still laugh my ass off every time I watch it. So I have a very eclectic taste in movies, to say the least. One thing I've been disappointed with is movies. It's been hard to find really good movies after about 2018 or so. So I've been falling back on the classics, it seems. But there was one movie I saw recently that I liked a lot from the last 4 or 5 years, and that was International Falls. And that's the one it's a movie I really like. It has a Fargo, it's sort of a Fargo vibe to it because it's in Minnesota, but it's a comedy that I thought was really good because it talks about how comedians think. And that's one I wanted to throw out there. You can find it if you look around on any of those free streaming services.
Sounds good. Does it have a wood chipper?
It does. It mentions the wood chipper in the movie.
Well, now it's a must see.
There's a hilarious scene where this guy's like, guy's talking to the lady, and her lady realized her husband had cheated on her. She goes, "How would you want to get your revenge?" She goes, "Maybe a wood chipper." You know, like Fargo. But anyways, that's a movie that's the only really good movie that I've seen recently, like of the newer movies that I like a lot. So I'd be very interested to learn about new movies that are good.
Very cool. Well, thank you for that. What's that?
Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Your comments on the video were great, and somebody had recommended it, and I thought, oh hey, that's a good idea, why not?
Yeah,
one of our other listeners recommended it. Perfect.
Well, to that listener, thank you. I'm here now.
Let's see here. Well, let's kind of start talking about the game. This is a fun film. I think it's a fun film, even though it's got kind of a dark overtone to it. David Fincher, who had just completed Seven, directed this. There are little elements of it too, of Seven, that kind of carry over. Did you guys notice anything that kind of carried over from Seven into this film? Tanya, did something pop out to you?
Not anything in particular. I mean, aside from just the overall vibe of the uncovering the mystery, just the overall theme in general, but there was not a specific detail or moment that I would be like, that one, you know?
Ben, did something stick out to you at all?
Nothing in particular until you said that, and then I reflected and thought, yeah, exactly what Tanya said, the uncovering the mystery has a similar feel. But what made me say whoa just a minute ago was I never placed these two in similar spaces in time, the game and Seven. I think because I saw them at very different times in my life.
Fincher was going to direct this film first, and Brad Pitt became available. It was Brad Pitt, right? Yeah, in Seven. So yeah. He went and did Seven first, and then came back to do this one.
Wow. Okay.
So they literally are right on top of each other. Tony, did you notice anything that would carry it over from the films, or from Seven to this film?
You're going to get a good assist with this one. You were asking me about. I told you I was from San Francisco, and I had no idea that there was good weather when I moved to Oakland. San Francisco is a very gloomy, cold city. Just that alone makes the perfect vibe for that would give a reference to Seven in and of itself. I know the area where a lot of the downtown scenes, because I used to work there. And this movie was in 1997, so I was maybe 4 years prior to when that was filmed. I was working in those exact, within a few blocks. I used to have lunch in those areas. So It that area is very gloomy. And if you go there on a Saturday when it's not a work day, it's really a lonely, kind of quiet place. So that part of downtown San Francisco. So I thought it definitely, that vibe, I definitely noticed a lot of stuff in 7.
Are you talking about the financial district?
Yes, the financial where they filmed it at, like around
LA is like that too. The financial district in LA does it's the exact same thing. Everything shuts down there when the businesses aren't operating.
It's, ghost
it's creepy.
Yeah, exactly.
The one thing I did catch that I felt like kind of gave me a little bit of a clue that this was the same director was during the psych eval, when he's sitting there in front of the projector. You get the flashes and the subliminal flashes and the weird innuendo and whatnot. That was the one moment I went, oh, okay, now I can connect the director between these two films. But otherwise, I felt that he did a good job distancing himself from the type of content that was in 7 with the type of content that was in this film. This, as dark as this film gets, it actually has a lighthearted, happy kind of ending. And we all know 7 doesn't.
You mentioned that. Yeah, you mentioned that one aspect of the film that was wrong. That brought up to me Clockwork Orange all the way.
Yeah, it does have a parallel with that, doesn't it? That's a good point. Only he didn't have his eyes,
Exactly. He didn't have the forks on his eyes. He wasn't forced to watch it.
I'd have gone for that. But anyway, so one of the big things, there's a lot of parallels with this film and other stories. The big one being, the Scrooge story, right? A Christmas Carol. You guys, did you notice any parallels between A Christmas Story or other films that popped out to you regarding this particular story? Ben, did anything kind of jump out at you?
Didn't particularly jump out at me. I definitely see the similarities. But while I was watching the movie, they didn't, again, to use that phrase, they didn't jump out at me. This is a movie that, it's the kind of movie my brain really loves to immerse itself into. And so I really wasn't thinking much about, okay, what's similar between this and other films. Instead, I was just wholeheartedly in there going through all of the paranoia and fear that Nicholas was going through.
Tanya, something that stuck out to me in this film was when you compare it with, say, like A Christmas Carol, both of the men that are at the center of the story are traumatized by the death of a male figure in their life. For Nicholas, it's his father. For Ebenezer Scrooge, it's Jacob Marley. Did you make any other crossover parallels between these stories at all? Or did you see anything?
I definitely get the connection and why you would sort of associate those two. I do think that there is, throughout the movie, little flashes of inspiration or realization that Nicholas comes to about, caring for his wife, needing his brother, letting go of his father, all of those little moments. You could totally relate those to Scrooge. And then also the ending, though, I feel like Scrooge did genuinely become a good person. I feel like that might be up in the air with Van Orton a little bit, but we can discuss that later.
Yeah, they don't really satisfy that, do they?
No.
Tony, how about you? When you were watching this, and I don't know how familiar I don't know how familiar you are with A Christmas Carol or, say, It's a Wonderful Life or, these redemption type arc films, but did anything strike you as similar to another story that you feel like, oh, this reminds me so much of this?
Yes, but before I say that, I have to preface by saying I almost, because of how I watched the game, I wasn't focusing on that. Now that you brought it up, it's very apparent. But I kind of almost watched the game like I was Ebenezer Scrooge, because there was a lot of Schadenfreude when you watch it. He's kind of you're rooting for the game, and I was rooting for the game in the beginning because he was such a mean person in the beginning, and so I was almost laughing at the stuff that was happening to him. He was in such control of his life. So that's I have to preface my answer by saying that's how I watched the movie. But yeah, actually, It's a Wonderful Life is what came to mind. It's the ending of It's a Wonderful Life. You see, James Stewart. His character at the end was basically beyond. He was at the as a breaking point, and I think he had both of them at the breaking points. They were both going to kill themselves. He was at the bridge, and he actually went for it. You know, so he actually went one step beyond where. He didn't have the angel coming and rescuing. The only angel that rescued him was CRS, ironically, if you think about it. By having that little thing catching him, bang, right down in the middle.
CRS, you know, that's funny because CRS, it can mean so many things. And in the film, it means a lot of different things too. But when I was growing up, CRS meant, can't remember. My grandparents always said, you know. So I just thought it was funny that was the acronym that they chose for that. I'll probably have to bleep that because it is YouTube, but whatever. So there's a couple of other parallels that I saw between Christmas Carol and this. And I hate to stick on this, but as I was watching this, these things became somewhat apparent to me. It's Nicholas's brother is the one who it basically tells him that he needs to live his life and get out of that like dark place. And in Christmas Carol, it's Ebenezer's nephew. So again, a family member comes to them, you know, pleading with them to change their ways. So there's another parallel. And then the other parallel I found was that both men must see their graves in order to finally hit that point of redemption, hit that redemption point. You have Ebenezer is taken to his grave, and then you have Nicholas Van Horton wakes up in a grave in Mexico. So yeah. I just felt like those were really strong moments, and I wasn't sure if this is something other viewers like saw or if I was just putting this into the film because I felt like it was so well. Obviously you've got rich guy redemption arc, but it just felt like wow. I mean it all you have to do is twist the story a little bit and it becomes a completely new thing. I don't know.
Wow, that's interesting. I would actually be curious if our viewers want to comment about if there are any other parallels that they noticed. That's kind of fascinating.
Right. The film sort of gives you this sensation that real change can't happen for people unless they hit rock bottom. Did you guys get any other major points that jumped out at you like that? Tanya, did something stick out to you as like a message the film was trying to give you?
Yes, actually. So for me, the theme of this film is very much your background. You have Michael Douglas puzzle pieces and they're slowly falling, filtering away. And the things that he loses or thinks he loses are pieces of his identity that don't necessarily matter. You cling to your possessions. You cling to certain ideas about yourself that may or may not be accurate, and they become armor to the point where you can be so isolated that you're not living. And that for me was the ultimate message of the film, was him just sort of peeling back, letting go of those layers to become a more authentic himself.
Interesting. That's a really good point. Ben, how about you? How do you feel about that?
Similarly, one of the things that I saw throughout the first part of the film was something that I have seen in a lot of people I have met over the years who have, far more money than they need to survive. And they fairly much as Tanya said, they armor themselves in this concept of themselves. And one thing that I saw Nick Van Orton do several times was lie to someone about what actually happened, because what actually happened made him feel as though he looked somewhat lesser. For example, having his application for the game rejected. He couldn't even be honest with his own brother about that. Told him, "Oh, I got a lot of stuff going on. I don't think it's going to work out now." And I spent the first lonely moment of years of my life watching and hearing people do that again and again and again. I'm sure they still do, and I just learned to ignore them, or just, you know, kick them out of my life. And I loved that he started doing that a whole lot less, and even ultimately learned to beg total strangers for help with the change that he counted in his pocket.
Oh, that was a brilliant touch. Tony, I noticed that you brought up earlier that you felt that the game was something you should root for. And part of that is because the character himself is so unlikable, right? He seems happy in his miserableness, is the way I'd put it. What stood out to you about this character, and what makes you ultimately root for him?
It's funny. I guess the part that I rooted for him was the part is paradoxically the schadenfreude that I mentioned. I mean, I kind of look at myself when I've been in situations where I felt like the whole world was against me. I remember a couple of moments in my life, and I kind of reflect on myself, actually. And I remember one time I drove to work, just a 5-minute drive to work. And I think I accidentally, I say accidentally, I really meant it. I accidentally cut somebody off. And at the same time, somebody was trying to pass me. They beeped their horn at me. Somebody else looked, gave me a mean, they all gave me this major attitude. I almost felt like there was a conspiracy against me. And when I got out of the car and I was walking, other people, a homeless person started swearing the crap out of me. And I just felt like everybody was ganging up on me at the same moment. And it kind of, that's kind of what I was laughing. I remember how I felt. I felt kind of the same way, like a Nicholas Stenwood. So I kind of had empathy for him in the end. I think it's so, just the suffering he went through. You can
the
kind of
karmic retribution is what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Gotcha. It's interesting because that's your take, and that's what made you empathize with him, because the film very weakly tries to make him sympathetic by making him an orphan by killing his father. And we've talked about this on our podcast before, is that being an orphan is this built-in sympathy mechanism that films use and stories use quite a bit. For me, it's not a character flaw. I'm sorry, it doesn't generate sympathy to me at all. But for a lot of people, apparently that is a thing. Tanya, is that the thing that worked for you that made him sympathetic, or did you find something else?
That was not the thing that made me sympathetic. Although I will say the footage of him as a little boy in the beginning was a really masterful touch. It tells you a lot just about him and it shows you what he could have been, and also little glimpses of his desperately sad father, which was just kind of haunting. But I think the moment for me that I really connected with him wasn't until he got to Mexico. It took a while for me to really feel great amounts of empathy for him, particularly when he had to give away his father's watch. That was a moment, because you knew how much that broke him, and that was just very sad. Mm. Yeah. But it took a long time.
Yeah. Ben, were you able to empathize right away with Nicholas Van Orton, or did it also take you some time?
I was able to empathize instantly with Nicholas Van Orton, not perhaps for any expected reason, but for just little fragments of the home movies showed him holding his little baby brother and then looking up at the camera and giving this big giant Kool-Aid man grin. He was just so pleased to have this little baby brother. And my brother is far and away the very best friend I've ever had, not only in my entire life, but throughout my entire life. So that hooked me right there. I recognized that this is a tremendously flawed and damaged person who was insanely difficult to like. But I still felt, okay, there's something that he loves his little brother. There's something good there. There's a human being inside.
Hmm. Wow. Well said. Good point. And it's interesting where we find that moment that we connect with the character. I don't know where it was, honestly, as I was watching it. I definitely did not like the character in the beginning of the film. I think the one thing that got me, though, and I feel like this was also a masterful touch, was I didn't feel bad about the whole orphan thing. And okay, yeah, his dad killed himself. But when that clown dropped onto the ground, or was laying on the ground,
he was just laying.
That right there was like, that's a effed up thing to do to somebody whose father jumped to their death.
Well, I was laughing at that. That's a sad thing.
It was really like, messed
there's up. Empathy, but I was laughing. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and then I'm thinking, well, what is, and I didn't remember because I saw this film. The last time I saw this film was in the theater when it came out. So when he walked up to it, I forgot that it was a clown. I'm thinking, oh, wait, what? Oh, this is horrible. And then he picks up, it's the clown. And that's when I started laughing. But I don't know. There's a lot of things in this film that I felt were really kind of cool. One of the things is the idea that, and I think the director, sorry, I just said like several different sentences went different directions, but where I'm going is this.
I never do that.
Michael Douglas is famously known for playing Gordon Gekko.
Yes.
Right? In Wall Street. And that character completely sells his soul for money, is irredeemable. Yet in this film, you've got Michael Douglas playing an investment banker, a very similar type character, who has sold his soul for money and is basically just a miserable, you know, horrible human being. But he gets a chance at redemption. He grows up a bit, and he theoretically repudiates this lifestyle. It feels like Fincher basically killed off Gordon Gekko.
Gordon Gekko.
Any thoughts on that?
What was that last part? I'm sorry.
I said it feels like Fincher killed off Gordon Gekko. Any thoughts about that? Did anything else jump out in that regard as to Fincher's ideals towards people of wealth? Or do you think it's more just a story he told? Or do you think that maybe there's a reason that he did things the way he did? Is getting rid of a character like Gordon Gekko something that, you know, is a life goal?
Possibly.
Oh, funny.
Because there's one moment that has always stood out and actually is my primary memory of the movie. Whenever anyone mentions it, whenever anything brings my brain close to it, the first thing that leaps to mind is when Nicholas Van Orton and the waitress Christine are running away from the unimaginably well-trained attack dog. As they're trying to get away from that ferocious attack dog, Nicholas loses one of his shoes. And in a totally, completely unnecessary moment, he makes the comment, there goes $1,000. And Christine looks at him in shock, says, your shoes cost $1,000? He says, that one did. And I thought, that really had no point being in the film. Someone just really wanted to make that statement about how self-absorbed rich assholes can be.
There was another one like that. I can't remember, but there was another one similar to that.
And when I first saw this movie, that was a tremendous moment of realization for me that, yeah, I had always been aware that there are people who are rich and have lots of money. That was when it really hit home that, oh my God, there are people who have shoes where one of the two shoes can cost $1,000.
Oh yeah. I know people who buy outfits and they only ever wear it once.
There are people who just have unconscionable amounts of money. It really introduced me to the scale of vast differences of wealth in our world.
Yeah, I will say too, I did notice in the beginning, not just in the clown scene, but there was a morning where he had the news program on in the background, and on the news, it was always a story about, you know, bills for workers that weren't going to get passed, or workers being injured on like an oil platform or something, or there was always something. You really got the sense of that there was like the working class, and then he as this capitalist guy really couldn't give a crap. And that was very well evidenced by the way that he treated people, his assistant and the secretary and the waitresses, just really not nice to anyone who wasn't sort of his status.
You bring up the employees, and that first time where the I guess it's the secretary comes in and says, "Happy birthday." I don't like that woman. Immediately, my thought was, "Bah humbug."
Yeah. Oh, quick side note that's kind of fun. Marie, who played, I guess, his assistant or his executive assistant, she was Lieutenant Commander Shelby in Star Trek The Next Generation. I recognized the voice and I was like, oh my God, I know her. Yep. Awesome. Shelby.
Oh, where he exaggerated his wealth, it was when she spilled the drink on him and she said, "That's going to cost more than your dry cleaning."
Ah, that's it.
I think so.
Right. There's an interesting point in the film too. There's a little flaw where he gets some, is it the ink? Oh yeah, the ink on his shirt. He goes to wash it in the bathroom. It's a different shirt. Just so, something to look for when you're watching that little flaw in the film.
Editor catch.
For me, what I felt like was a touch of genius in making this film work, because this film relies on so many things going right that you had to create a justification for it. And the way they did that was the psych profile. Right? Here's your fallback. We can predict what he's going to do based off of the answers he gives us on this test. How did you guys feel about that? And we'll start with Tony this time, since we started with them last time. What do you think?
That's where this is a special movie, because I thought I was not convinced that the psych would get him that much information on, but it was fun that it worked out that way, and I appreciate it. But I was like, this guy, Nicholas, he couldn't have been that gullible. It was hard for me to imagine being that gullible, that he would have stayed there for 4 hours. This is a Wall Street man who doesn't have time to... So I had issues with that, but it was a convenient excuse, just like it was convenient that he happened to land right on the bullseye at the end. But what's surprising, as annoying as that is, I still enjoy watching this movie over and over. So I'm able to let go of it. And I don't know if you guys have seen Siskel and Ebert's take on it. Ebert kind of, they argued, Siskel's a skinny guy. Siskel's like, I liked the movie, but it was so pretentious, you can't take it seriously. So I thumbs down. Or Ebert's like, well, come on, it's a game. Come on, you got to go along with the game. So he gave it a thumbs up. And I kind of understand Ebert's take on that. It's like, you got to let those things that aren't believable happen and just accept it. But
I did see Ebert's review. I did not see Siskel's. So
I saw them arguing. So yes, he gave a very nonchalant, I don't think so.
Awesome. Ben, what did you feel about the psych profile? I mean, if you think about a modern day parallel, it'd be somebody posts something on Facebook and they ask you a bunch of questions that you have to answer, right? All these things. Here's your passwords and stuff. Nowadays, we're conditioned to actually look for it and know that, okay, don't do this. This is a hacker's way into your world.
Exactly.
Right.
In 1997, nowadays, would that have been, do you feel that he should have been a little more aware?
Great question. Because airports back then, as you saw, his lawyer could walk up to him at the airport. This is pre-9/11.
Right.
So right. There's a more gullible back in that time than we are now.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to bother with a preamble there. No, the psych eval is a complete load of hogwash. We can do a lot of pretty amazing stuff with psych evals, but the level of accuracy and precision required to control his decision making through the kinds of moments they put him in, absolutely, entirely, in all ways impossible to do. Far too detailed. To predict future events.
Yeah, I don't know about that, Ben.
From even our best psyche vows. At the same time, did not diminish my enjoyment of the film at all. Because even while I was seeing that and kept saying to myself, okay, look, there's no way that they could actually know that he would do this in that exact moment.
All right.
Even as I knew that...
It's 9 o'clock.
apparently it's not.
It's 9 o'clock.
Gary, shut up.
Oh, that was fun. I think that's the first
one. Speaking about robots, I'm getting to the moon.
But even with that, it didn't bother me because I was simply able to accept the conceit of the film. That, okay, they have the ability to make these predictions. What I continued to be amazed at was the incredible amounts of resources that they must have to pull together that alarmingly huge cast of people to place all around him.
And always be in the right place at the right time.
How much do you think that bill was?
It had to
probably
be
as much as
millions.
The film cost to make.
Yeah, if not the tens of millions. I mean, it was phenomenal, the things that they had to pull together and pull together in an incredibly short amount of time. And another thing I kept thinking was, it's an amazingly scaled up fun game of make-believe, especially if the person playing doesn't know he's playing a game.
There are some points that I'd like to talk about in a little bit about what you just brought up, but I'd like to also hear Tanya's opinion on this. What do you think, Tanya?
I did not mind the psych evaluation as a fallback for him making the decisions. They also made a point, Ben mentioned the large cast of characters, and I'm sure that they played a huge role in pushing him in certain directions. If he wasn't maybe doing something that they wanted him to do, they would just say something or do something, or, you know. So I'm sure
nudge,
it was
nudge.
Yeah, wink wink, nudge nudge, exactly. One thing that I found really interesting, though, it sort of speaks to, like, he sat in that room getting that evaluation for hours and hours and hours and hours. And there were other moments in the film where he was really obsequious when it came to authority figures. Like, he would pay attention to signs. He's like, no, we have to listen to the cops. We have to listen to, you know. And for someone who was such this wealthy kind of go-getter guy, it seemed uncharacteristic. But I found that interesting that he was still very, very rules-based and willing to concede to authority so quickly.
Yeah, you don't become a very, very wealthy investment banker by following the rules and not taking some souls along the way.
Right.
I had a specific thought about his responses to the idea of authority, and thinking about the cops when he and Christine were in the suddenly emptied out building, which they thought they were being taken to a hospital, and they're in the CRS building that's all empty, and one of them passes through a laser trip wire and alarms start blaring. Christine says, oh my God, we gotta get out of here. His immediate response is just perfectly calm. Oh no, we'll wait for them to show up. We'll explain everything and it'll all be fine. And I thought, you are such a rich white man. you're in the middle of the emptied out financial district of a major metropolis in a building that reeks of wealth. The alarms are blaring, you're the only one there, and you think the cops are going to listen to you. And you think they're going to take you seriously and believe you. And it was so very rich and so very white. But that rather than him respecting authority, it felt more to me like he knows that authority is there to serve him.
Yeah,
Good point.
I agree, because that's the fix-all for him.
It's always another wealth thing.
Yeah, it's a good point. What you'd brought up earlier actually brings me around to this idea that I had. There doesn't seem to be any real antagonist in this film. CRS has basically got some actors, but it's mostly faceless people, right? There's the threat of these guys with guns coming after him. Which they explain away with, little packs that explode, and it's very elaborate. There's also the fact that the police in San Francisco don't seem to be present at all. It's all the security forces of CRS, which tells you that CRS is somehow enmeshed with the government and with the police department, and somehow have the permission to let this game go on. At least we're supposed to assume that. How do you feel about that? Tony, what did you think when when you started realizing, well, not one single cop. What's going on here?
They're all in the Tenderloin.
As a person who's parked their car on the Tenderloin and went back to find it and couldn't find it, yes, I agree.
Well, yeah, seriously speaking, that was down, that part of downtown would have been, it's very dead, so that would be strategically not a place where you'd want your cops to be. But still, they should have eventually showed up, I would think.
So, I mean, with gunfire and all that, you would think.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tanya, did any of that sort of make you say,
Indeed it did. Even to the point where they replaced a giant roof of a hotel with breakaway glass. Like, how do you do that? I don't, like, yeah. So
massive
clearly
resources.
massive
sugar glass.
Resources. Sugar glass, yummy.
I mean, you just pull the glass off the top and you set it to the side, right?
There you go.
Easy peasy. Yeah. 10 minutes tops. I do want to address the thought that there doesn't seem to be an antagonist. That's after the first time you watch the movie. The first time you watch the movie, there is definitely a Skynet out there trying to kill you.
There's a conspiracy.
Only it's called CRS. I mean, it's the same thing. Now, of course, in the Terminator movies, there was, you know, robotic Schwarzenegger stomping after you and shooting you and with one-liners and stuff. But in this movie, there still is that there's a perfectly good word that I'm completely blanking on here. There's this horrible, scary, nameless, faceless entity that is sending waves of people with malicious intent after you. So it's there until you know the answer after you've watched the movie.
Yeah. Something that occurred to me was that this film is very, very patriarchal, male-centric. I don't know how many of you caught that, but the women in this film tend to be mostly spurned. You've got the ex-wife, who apparently Nicholas Van Orton treated poorly, and
Nicholas
she left
Van Gecko.
Him. Nicholas Van Gecko.
was it her gynecologist that he left him for? That's what I almost wondered, because how would she have been able to find a gynecologist? It almost seems the relationship was so sterile that her only love she could find is dump this Nicholas guy who's a total snob. And that actually went through my mind wondering if that's
it is. It's an interesting point, isn't it? And then we don't learn anything about his mother. Well, we don't really truly learn anything about his father either. If you think about it, right. We just know that he killed himself. In fact, if his father had been shot, he could have been Batman.
I'm Batman.
We don't get any details on this guy, or his father and mother had been shot. But the mother is never mentioned in the film. And the women in this film are all in roles of either
Bruce Wayne and Gordon Gekko is who killed the parents.
The women in this film are all like in some form of subservience. If you think about it, you've got the secretary, you've got the woman that works for him at his house. Mm-hmm. And then you've got even the waitress in the beginning. And I wonder if they chose that profession on purpose to work her way in. Did that strike anybody when they were watching this? Did that even enter your mind? Tanya, was that something, especially as a woman, is this something that jumped out at you at all?
Not necessarily. I did notice it, but it wasn't something I wasn't thinking to myself, oh, he's totally sexist. It was more just like, he's an ass, and he's an ass to everybody. Equal opportunity ass, if you will.
I didn't necessarily mean him. I meant the film itself. There was sort of this detachment to women. And
yeah.
And the one waitress was pretty independent, though.
Right. But she's the one she's working for CRS, though, right? Is that the one you're talking about? Yeah, Christine.
Right.
What did you guys think of her performance? I thought she did a pretty good job. I didn't even know. I had no idea who she was. In fact, I did a little looking up trying to figure out who our spotlight was going to be on tonight. And I thought about her, but I didn't recognize her from anything. Do you guys know her from anything?
This Highlander is the only one I know.
I don't know her from anything either, but her performance was great. She did this wonderful job of, you trust her and you like her, and then you do give a little side eye, like, well, I don't know, this is a little strange, just, you know. So it really had you on edge, and she played that sort of undulation really, really well.
Part of the game. And you brought up a point when we were taking a little break there, Ben. When did the game start? You want to elaborate on that and share it with our viewers, since you felt like talking about it while I was going to the bathroom?
Okay. Thoughts are going ahead.
Well, that's the best time to talk about stuff, man, because then, you know, you can't hear it.
I heard you.
I don't have a clown in my room, do I?
You do.
Damn it.
He's sitting right there.
In my chair, right here with me.
Oh. Ding dong. We've got pictures, bro.
Yeah, what you may not know, Tony, is that I am a clown.
Oh, you didn't know.
Was trained by a troop and painted my face and did all the wild pratfalls that messed up my elbow for a while. Loved it. Lots of fun. I will say, never trust dead clowns.
Oh, yeah. Especially ones that have keys in their mouths.
I know, right? Those guys are always up to something. It's difficult to tell when Nicholas Van Orton, not Van Gecko, Nicholas Van Orton's game actually began. And it's ostensibly it began when he walked into the office of CRS, filled out the paperwork, and endured a really, really long evaluation. But I kept thinking to myself that the very fact that evaluation went so very, very long, especially for a powerful investment banker whose time is precious, and they managed to keep him there so very long, tells me that they already knew something about how to manipulate him.
Mm. Yeah, Tony, what do you think? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't realize there's more.
One thing that I was asking Ben is, you noticed when Nicholas had that birthday with the Seymour Butts reference? That was funny too, by the way.
Yeah.
Have you heard about Books Never Written? That was a funny reference, but I forgot what the book was called. Under the Bleachers by Seymour Butts.
Yellow River by I.P. Freely. All those things we did as a kid.
Yeah but what we noticed is when they were at that dinner place, I noticed the waitress was the same waitress from the game. And this is before he'd even gotten the gift. And so that made us wonder if maybe Conrad, when he went to London, he had already started as a buying the gift for his brother, was already giving them data on him, so to speak. Because as we were able to prove that they're very close, they got a lot, there's a certain intimacy that they had between each other. So he knew his brother really well, knew his touching points, his vulnerabilities. Yeah. That could have gotten started. So maybe when he was taking the exam, they knew he was giving bullshit answers based on what his brother had told him, which basically allowed him to develop an even better algorithm about how his mind works.
Well, you guys have brought up a really good point. And Tanya, what do you think? When do you think the game started?
Gosh, that's a really good question. And I honestly don't know. Watching the movie, I had always assumed it started as soon as he got the card and the little invitation. It never occurred to me that it began before that. Quick little side note, I find it very telling, just a really great character moment for Nicholas when he gets the card from Conrad and he opens up the card and he just pulls out the invitation. He doesn't even bother to glance at the card or did he write anything inside for me? There was none of that. It was just straight to, here's my gift. Such an excuse me. Am I allowed to see? You might have to bleep that. Sorry.
Self-help.
You guys assume there's some kind of bleeper here. There is no bleeper. I actually am going to have to find a sound effect to put over that.
But in any case, I think that the game had definitely started when they had
his birthday, maybe.
Yeah, when he got the invitation was Yeah. That was the moment.
That would be my guess. I think what we should do is put this up to the viewers. When do you, if you've seen this film, which at this point, if you're watching this, we're going to assume that you have. When do you feel that the game began? We'll put the question down in the comments, and please feel free to answer and tell us when you think you thought the game started.
Indeed.
Yeah. Hey, we should involve our viewers and listeners more. And for those that are listening, we'll also put it up on our Facebook so you can find it there, since you know, this show does appear in multiple formats. It shows up on YouTube, and it's also on a bunch of podcatchers as an Audible show. We haven't forgotten about you. Maybe Ben has, but the rest of us haven't. One of the other things that really sticks out to me is that you could almost call this film red herrings, or, you know, it's like 2 hours of red herrings and, you know, whatever they could do to completely keep you guessing. And I think this film is predictable and unpredictable at the same time. I think that's why it works so well. Like, oh, I expect this to happen. Okay, that happened. Oh, I didn't expect that to happen. In this cast, there appear to be only two people that are not in on the game. Did anything stick out to you guys? I know who I believe were the two people. How about you guys? Okay. Tanya, did you find that there was anybody else who wasn't in on the game?
I honestly thought that everybody was in on the game. There was nobody that I trusted by the end. I'm like, everybody, there's not a single person that is not somehow responsible for this. That was always my impression, except for maybe, oh God, what was his name? Bauer?
Bear.
Was it Bauer? Bear.
Anson, okay. Bear.
Yes, him. Maybe he was not. And
his attorney, name, right?
But no, the guy that he fired.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So I would say there are three.
Who's the third?
The attorney.
Oh, well, I'd say the attorney and Anson Bear would be my picks. Who would be the third? Besides, oh, well, Michael Douglas, right? The main character.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I thought you were including Michael Douglas.
No, okay. I just meant of side characters.
Aside from him. Okay, yeah. Then just those two.
And the reason... Go ahead.
Anson Bear, that's the guy who owned the company, right?
The bookstore.
I thought he was in on it too, because he was at the party at the end waiting for him to land on the thing. Wouldn't he be
I think he got filled in. I don't think he was in on it to begin with, because remember when... when Nicholas storms in with all those pictures and assumes that he's behind it, he makes a complete fool of himself in front of him. But I also think the attorney wasn't involved, because when he calls him and says, my accounts, they've all been hacked, da, 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 he says, your accounts are fine. I'm looking at it right here. And immediately, Christine is like, oh, he's in on it. She's covering right away for what looked like something that they hadn't anticipated. At least that's the way it appeared to me.
That's how it looked to me too.
I thought that could have.
I was gonna say just that I thought that Christine's character did a good job of covering certain moments that got a little too close to having him peel back the curtain too soon. So that was basically, I felt that was her role. She's the basic safety for that within the game.
Peeling back the curtain. He doesn't even say that at one point. I want to peel back the curtain.
I think he did.
Yeah. Nice little...
It's probably why I went to that phrase.
Wizard of Oz.
Because it was in my brain.
Yeah.
One thing that I did want to bring up, you had mentioned the fact that there were a lot of red herrings in the game, or in the movie, The Game. One of the things visually that struck me about the film this time around was the use of color in this movie. So much of it was a neutral background with just really beautiful textures and kind of umptuousness. But particularly from the Mexico scene on, there is red everywhere. Like when he's in the walking down the street or in the visa office or wherever he is, everybody's in neutrals, except occasionally an extra will walk by. They're all in some shade of red. All the signage is red. It's just a really interesting touch, and it just made me think of that. And I was like, gosh, that's a curious directorial decision, but it was nice. It was very pleasant to the eye.
That's an age-old cinematic tell. And I did take some film school, And that was one of the things that we focused on, was use of color, and specifically red in films. If you see a character wearing red, it usually signifies that they're in danger. If you see red, it tends to be a portent or an omen of danger or of something bad about to happen. So the choice of using the red there was probably extremely, or not probably, it was intentional. But the fact that I didn't really think about it, which is really cool that you noticed it and brought it up for this discussion. Did anybody else catch the color change or the portents put out by the director?
I'd be interested to rewatch those parts to see if how I, in retrospect, think about how I reacted to that scene. And if I started thinking there was a scary moment, then I got subliminalized without even knowing it.
Yeah, that's
kind of cool, actually. That,
I've been subliminalized. I love it. I'm totally going to steal that word.
Subliminalized.
I did notice in Mexico that
I was in control of my life. I'm not in control. The game got me. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's a good, interesting point. You didn't get you. You saw the red. So
there's that psychic value filled up before you watched it. Yeah,
exactly. I'm not talking to anybody from here now.
I noticed a different tint while he was in Mexico, but then I stopped noticing it when he was back in San Francisco afterwards. And it was interesting. In Mexico, I noticed it, and it kind of annoyed me because I kept thinking that this color is wrong.
It was very
bleak. And I think that's the reason why I noticed it, though, because typically in my head I always think of Mexico as a location, as a very vibrant, colorful place, and it was so muted down, and it really made you notice the red more. And that just, it was a very odd kind of jarring thing, because it's just not what you think of. So
I felt like it was very bleached out, and it gave you the sensation that it was very hot there. As a juxtaposition to San Francisco, where it's, as Tony has pointed out, it's foggy and murky and dark. The Mexico thing was to give you that sensation that he's definitely somewhere else, and he's a long way away from home. But it really does make that stand out. Now that you've brought it up, now I feel like I have to rewatch this, and I'm wondering how much longer my rental's for.
One thing there's about this movie, because it's in my hometown, so I think I watched the movie thinking about what was I doing when this movie was filmed. But there was one particular scene, it's a very nonchalant scene where they're at a Chevron gas station. I'm pretty sure, I'm probably about 75% sure, I wanted to double check it, but I'm pretty sure it's the one on Unipro Serra near SF State. That's where I went to, college.
Yeah, cool.
And that's one I'd been to many times. I have a fond memory of that, where a friend of mine, we had a game to see how long we could stay awake, and we met at midnight at that actual Chevron gas station. And that was when we started our game to see who could stay, and we ended up basically staying awake for about 48 hours, and then we were
we've all been there.
We were just going on a long road trip, right? Basically.
Back when our bodies could handle that kind of thing.
Yeah, not anymore, yeah.
I was going to say, once upon a time, I was young enough to be able to do that.
Anyone under 30 right now is watching this going, what?
You will learn.
Let's move on to our next segment. It's called
Could Have Done Without That.
This is where we get a moment to talk about something in the film that didn't work for us. And we'll go ahead and start with our guest. Tony, was there something in the film that you just felt like, that shouldn't have been in there? Or I really didn't need that.
I always get annoyed by cliches, and White Rabbit is a cliche. I'm sick of White Rabbit being conjured up and reused.
Could have done without that.
Find a different song to get that same atmosphere, you know? The other thing, this one is, there was one particular scene, I called it kind of a cliche too, is the fact, what is it about suicidal fathers and this blurred memory? I guess he had old cameras back then, or old footage. But I brought back the movie Marathon Man, when Dustin Hoffman's dad had committed suicide and he was thinking about his dad. It went back to that film. And it also made me think about Julia Roberts in Flatliners, where she was thinking about her father.
Yeah.
I think he killed himself too.
Yeah.
But I just saw a lot of parallels there. And it's Well, and actually, I guess it's worked, but to me, it gets too gimmicky when you start conjuring up. I start thinking of other movies like that, you know, so it's kind of distracting me a little bit.
Wow,
but
Flatliners.
It's still a nice scene, though, but...
Thank you for bringing up Flatliners. That's going to go on the list of potential films we're going to do. I love that film. Tanya, how about you? What could you have done without?
Honestly, not much. I mean, obviously, there were certain things in the film that you're like, oh, I don't know. But you just have to suspend your disbelief and just roll with it. It's just one of those movies. The only thing that I can't get past is, how do they know that he is going to walk exactly to that spot on the roof?
Could have done without that.
Get to the edge of the roof at some point. There were no barriers in the way. There was nothing. And I could see any other decision that he made. I could be like, all right. It's like someone could have guided him to this or done something. But that was a decision that there was no way they could have predicted. So that was like, oh, it bothered me just a little. But
we are in
I forgive
alignment
it.
There. We well, are in alignment.
They did address that.
Yeah, it was too convenient.
They did address that exact particular point afterwards at the party. There's a very particular character, the one who administered the psych eval tests, who's actually an actor I like seeing. Anyway, he came to Nick Van Orton and said, I'm so glad you took that leap, because if you didn't, I had to get you there and throw you off. So they sort of hung a hook on it. He said, we know that was a little hinky, but we had this plan in place. This guy was supposed to throw you in the right place.
Yeah, the problem was that he was too far away from him, and it's still I'm totally with Tanya on that. My couldn't have done without that. That's actually part of it. But what did you actually have, something that you didn't agree with or you thought shouldn't have been in the film?
Not fully 100%. It's just a little aspect of their of CRS's business model that I just keep thinking to myself, how can they possibly control that? There's the scene where Nick Van Orton, where Nick and Conrad are arguing and running after one another up and down these steep hills and stairways that are all covered in water, because it's, well, San Francisco at, you know, pick any month of the year, and it's wet, it's slick, and I didn't grow up in San Francisco, but around it, I've been there. I've watched people slip and fall, and it was the middle of the night. They were angry, and they were chasing each other, running up and down these. There's no way CRS can control whether or not one of them slips and breaks their neck. And on those hills, that is an extremely real possibility.
Especially at our age.
Yes. Oh, yes. Quick side note, that stairway scene, did anybody get full-on Exorcist vibes from that, or was it just me? The visuals? And I know you hate that movie, Ben, but...
No, it's okay. I didn't, but now that you say it, I totally see it. Yeah.
Ben would have only gotten Exorcist vibes if they had walked very slowly up the stairs and then continued
very
walking.
Very good point.
I had a moment.
Turn a corner, walk some more.
As we spent 10 minutes watching
the same
home movies.
For sure. Yeah.
We spent 10 minutes watching those old home movies, and I was thinking, "Well, Daniel's going to rid me about The Exorcist for this."
I had a picture from The Exorcist I was going to send you. You're absolutely right. So anyway, my could have done without that is literally a mix between both you and Tanya, Ben and Tanya here. I felt that it was a little too seamless.
Could have done without that.
That there were too many variables that went right. And I know you can justify it by saying, oh, well, you took the psyche value, but there was a lot of things that you just can't control that had to happen the exact right way. I would have liked to have seen more, you know, man behind the curtain fixing something real quick that... you know, that gave me some clue that, okay, this is being controlled on some level and it's being controlled very well. But they never gave us that really. It just all worked. And the jumping off the building thing was also a big a problem for me, because when he's up there, I'm thinking, oh God, you know, here, and I'd seen it before, but I'm looking at him realizing the street's right there. You can go to the other side. The street's right there. If he jumps off of either side there, and I'm like, how did this hit? He landed on a bag, right? And I'm like, wait. And then he goes over to the side where the staying where the glass window is, and I'm thinking, what the hell? Why would you jump there? You know, and I suppose that, you know, on some level, there's a part of him that's dramatic enough that he'd want that big sort of showy death where you go through all the glass. But predicting that and making that actually happen, I felt was a big stretch. And that was kind of I could have done without that. You know, at least give me something that tells me why he went that direction, you know, or something, put something over there that would make him avoid that side. Right. But they didn't do that. And then, of course, there was the weak thing that you brought up. Oh, I'm glad you jumped off it, because otherwise I'd have had to throw you off. Dude, you were leaning over a dead body, theoretically, yeah. And you weren't even paying attention to him.
You were not ready to do your job, Bubba.
No.
Do you think the movie might have been interesting had he not landed on the right spot?
Then the movie would have been very much more like Seven.
About the lawsuit involved for this company screwing it up.
Yeah, for real.
And then they show the ending, all the puzzle pieces going together, and somebody going, I just can't find this last piece. Anyway.
Someone finding a box with some indiscriminate piece in it and saying, what's in the box?
I'm going to introduce a new segment tonight. Okay. It's called...
Ooh, I'm excited.
Did you catch that?
Hmm.
There is a actor that shows up in this film that we all have seen, known, and loved. Did you catch that?
I caught one.
Was the salesman was in Meet the Parents.
This is from a previous episode we've done. This is an actor that we've talked about on this show.
Oh, hmm.
Was he one of the game's characters?
He may have. Well, he's probably in on it.
Okay.
The one that I saw was the main antagonist in The Karate Kid Part 2.
Yes! That's him.
That's the one I spotted.
That's
Yuji
Okumoto, who is also in Better Off Dead. Lane Meyer.
Oh, yes,
oh my
he was.
Gosh.
That was him.
Language oh lessons. That was him. And I was so excited when he showed up. I'm like, wait, oh.
I don't think I've ever realized that he was also the
That's a good actor.
He's the hotel manager.
Yeah, no, I never realized that the guy from Karate Kid, the antagonist from Karate Kid Part 2 was one of the Kamikaze twins from Better Off Dead.
Oh, well, there you go.
Now I know.
That's awesome.
So our next segment is...
I know that, dude.
I was so tempted to make it Sean Penn, because that's who says, yeah, I know that dude. It's from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, for those who've watched this. And I do put the little picture up there for those watching our show. Those listening, maybe you know it's him. But our subject today is James Rebhorn. Now, James Rebhorn, I'm familiar with. And the reason I'm familiar with him is because of a show we're going to do later on this season, Robotech. He wasn't in Robotech, but he was
going to say, wait a minute.
He was in the soap opera that my grandmother was watching before Robotech came on.
Oh my God.
Oh, that's a great connection. I love that.
Called The Guiding Light.
Wow. And my mom used to watch The Guiding Light.
Yeah. He played a character named Bradley.
The Tigerine commercial, right? In the movie, The Game.
What's that? Oh yeah. He did. Yeah. He was the guy that's how he figured out he was an actor.
Yeah. Right.
But
I didn't know that.
I'm curious if you guys are familiar with James Rebhorn at all, because he is one of those sort of like man of a thousand, you know, parts. He's done a million different things. His IMDb is huge. But does anybody remember him specifically from anything other than The Game, you know, or The Guide?
Independence Day.
Aha, because he was in that.
Independence Day.
Woman. He had his car splashed on with paint.
All right. Scent of a Woman, Independence Day. Yeah.
Yep. And then meet the parents. He was the he was the plastic surgeon, and his joke was, "Hey, now cut that out."
Oh gosh! that's awful. But it's so
awful. Introducing him. This is my father-in-law. He's a plastic surgeon. Like, "Hey, now cut that out."
Oh my!
That's funny. He's a good comedian, by the way.
Yeah. I know that I have seen him again and again in so many things. I just never remember almost any of them. But Independence Day is probably where I remember him the most.
CIA director.
Tanya.
CIA director who said he can't do that. And someone looks at him and says, well, he just did.
Tanya, I'd like to give you a chance to jump in on this because you've been very quiet. I want to know if you have any history or what your background is with the character actor James Rebhorn.
Independence Day. Exact same as Ben, because I'm like a sci-fi fanatic, so that's instantly where my mind goes. I was looking at his IMDb, his filmography, and he has been in everything, like such a prolific actor, and I'm sure that I've seen him act in other stuff, but I don't necessarily remember being conscious of it.
He's one of those guys that has a friendly face, so he's you can put him into roles that most actors would struggle with carrying off, that sort of like, but you can still trust me because look at me, you know. He sort of has that face, and that's what he is in this film when you think about it, because very quickly this character could become antagonistic in that office with just his personality and his demeanor and the way he looks. But this guy seems to pull off this, hey man, I'm just here to help you out, you know. Would you like some Chinese food?
You know? I would have gotten annoyed if someone said, hold this.
Right?
I loved that Dan Orton actually held it. I was surprised.
The little touches of them taking this powerful man and knocking him down. Little peg by little peg. I thought those were really nice touches in the methodology of CRS.
Great. In the wiki, they talk about his background quite a bit. We're not going to go into too much, but it says that he was known for portraying WASP stereotypes, lawyers, politicians, doctors, and military men, as well as portraying individuals engaged in or responsible for criminal behavior. There you go. Sadly, in 2014, James Rebhorn passed away. He died at his home as a result of melanoma at the age of 65. So it's interesting when we do these little backgrounds, because we get to focus in on somebody and learn a little bit about them. I was familiar with him, you know, and when I look at the list of things that he's been in, I start to remember him from those films. It's amazing how many times we'll pick an actor and do this, and I don't remember them being in the film or being in the television series. And I remember him. He stuck out to me because of that damn soap opera my grandmother watched. The Guiding Light. God, when is Robotech coming on? 4:30. Come on. Just admit you're the killer. Come on. All right. Anyway, there we go. Now we're going to do something that we love to do here at Popped. And we call this segment, Let's Get to Poppin', where we get to review our film here. All right, it's dance time. All right, Tony, do you hear the music? Yeah, it's disco.
Wee!
All right, so we have our esteemed guest here today, Tony Yucaina, right? Yucaina. We got that right.
Yes.
All right. And we want to know, how many pops on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being best, you would give the game?
I'm going to give this one a good 4 pops. I enjoyed the movie. I realize that the ending is not realistic, but it's a movie that I can watch over and over. So because I can watch it over and over, I can definitely give it 4, but I won't say it's a classic. I mean, it is a classic since I'll watch it over, but it's not one of my all-time favorites. So I'm going to give it 4.
Fair enough. Ben, how many pops would you give the game?
Similar to Tony, I give this game a solid 4 pops. I do love it. I do love rewatching it. There are enough little things that keep tickling at my mind that keep me from giving it a 5th pop, but nothing that stands out to really make me say, oh, I didn't like that. So,
all right.
Good solid 4. I'll keep watching it.
Fair enough. And Tanya, how many pops would you give the game?
I give it 4 pops as well. So far we are in unanimity. One thing that we never talked about was Michael Douglas. His performance in
Who's
this
that?
Film was so was so amazing and understated. And he really, to me, he exemplifies kind of a man out of time, because he really feels like an old Hollywood type of movie star. He has that vibe about him. Just really understated charisma. And it was just a really powerful but really subtle performance. And I thought he did an amazing job. Aside from that, loved the story, loved the twist. Totally didn't see it coming when I first saw it. And I still like to sort of imagine how they weave it into the story upon multiple viewings. And I love the direction, the lighting, the color palette was all really beautifully done. So I could solid 4.
Yeah. I give it 4 as well, because it's a really good film that I can rewatch. Like Tony said, I do have some issues with the ending. The fact that obviously everything has to happen perfectly for this film to work, but I can suspend my disbelief long enough to enjoy this film. And that's important, because that's really what makes it entertaining. You have to be able to do that. It's a good film. And to segue over to what you were talking about, Michael Douglas is an actor that I've enjoyed, oh God, since the 70s when he was in The Streets of San Francisco. You know, he's always been somebody...
I remember that show. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but my neurons started firing and I was like, oh my God. That's amazing.
He's been in so many good films, and he really is a decent actor who has a lot of range. And I think that another actor that had been put into this role, it may not have worked as well. He can do the guy that you loathe, like you absolutely loathe, but then he can flip it on its head and get so manic. He has that one ability to, when Michael Douglas's hair gets messed up, it's going down.
We should, for the record, really put that on a shirt and sell it in the pop shop. I'm just saying, just a thought.
Yeah, you know, I probably would have talked about him more, but he didn't come on the show. I mean, come on, man. I didn't really ask.
There might be a correlation there.
We want to thank everybody who's come along to watch the show or listen to the show, no matter which way you're doing it. We thank our Patreon supporters for supporting us. We want to let you know that we are going to be doing 2 episodes for you this month. And maybe by the time this comes out, that'll already have happened. So I don't know why I'm telling you now, but that's happening. We're going to take 2 episodes and put them into 1, which will make up for the fact that we didn't do one last month. Your support really means something to us. It really helps us out, and we thank you immensely for it. To everyone else who's listening and watching, absolutely. Please comment, like, do all the things. We really enjoy the interaction. Tony here got to be on the show because he commented on our video, and somebody recommended him and said, hey, why don't you go on their show? Well, if you want to come on this show, that's a good way to start. You can write us. I'm Daniel at Pop.
A whole bunch of long sentences.
Right. But they were great long sentences, extremely insightful long sentences, and creates interaction, which we really like. We really enjoy that when people do that. I'm Daniel at poppodcast.com. We got Ben at poppodcast.com, Tanya at poppodcast.com, and we're not going to give you Tony's email because he doesn't want to hear from you. So there you go. Anyway, with that, we're off, and we're leaving as well.